Welcome to the Exhale Podcast, a candid conversation about current matters relating to respiratory diagnostic and lung health. Today's hosts are Mark Russell, Marketing Communications Manager, and Troy Bridgen, Executive Vice President of Sales and Operations for Vitalgraph in North America, a global leader in respiratory diagnostics. Today, we interview Bill Pruitt, a writer, lecturer, and consultant. He has over 40 years of experience in respiratory care and has over 20 years teaching at the University of South Alabama in cardiorespiratory care. He enlightened us on the five valuable tips to achieve reliable, accurate results when performing spirometry tests to diagnose or manage COPD.
Well, welcome, Bill, to our podcast.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate the invitation to participate with you guys today and talk about spirometry and COPD.
Well, please give us a little background on yourself, education, experience, and your current responsibilities.
Well, I grew up in the Southeast. I traveled around a bit growing up, but spent a lot of years in Georgia. Initially started into a degree. My bachelor's degree is in English literature, and I found out after graduating with that degree, I couldn't do a lot with it. So I ended up going back into training and became trained as a respiratory therapist back in the 1980s, early 80s. Worked at a hospital in Augusta, Georgia for many years and worked my way up through responsibilities, became department manager eventually. The hospital went through a reorganization and I ended up in Atlanta when they kind of wiped out the middle management jobs. And so I was in Atlanta for a bit. And my wife is from Baton Rouge, and she wanted to get back closer to home. So I ended up in a job search mode and found a job teaching here in Mobile, Alabama, at the University of South Alabama. So we moved here in 1999. But at that time, I was a registered respiratory therapist and also picked up an MBA as a department manager. They wanted me to have some business training. When I started teaching, I was teaching in pulmonary function, which I knew some about, but was not really deep into it. But eventually, once I saw that, you know, it was a pretty fascinating topic, and I ended up getting certified as a pulmonary function technologist. That was in the early 2000s. And so I've taught PFT and spirometry and other pulmonary function testing for many years. I was an instructor and worked in to be higher up in levels of academia at the University of South Alabama, and ended up also picking up a certification as an asthma educator. Eventually, I also picked up the distinction of being a fellow in the American Association for Respiratory Care. And I've had a long years of working and teaching and doing things at bedside. I recently retired, I guess, just about the time COVID hit was about the time that I was able to retire. And since retirement, I've been doing a lot of writing, continue to write for different magazines and journals, and if I get the invitation, I'll come and speak. So I'm keeping my hand kind of in the real world, but I'm not working full time anymore. I'm working from home and getting to play a little more golf. That's kind of a background for me.
Well, that's a very interesting background. I can relate to it myself a bit. I was actually graduated with a bachelor's degree in psychology and came to the shocking realization I had no idea what I was going to do with it. Eventually parlayed that into my career now. But like you, a lot of that was, you know, very hands-on experience and kind of one role leading to the next and growing that skill set. So thank you very much for that background. We certainly appreciate it. Today, you know, we wanted to talk a bit about, you know, COPD. And I guess one of the first things I was curious to know is a lot of people that I talk to, like they've heard the term COPD. They may have heard the term emphysema or bronchitis, but I don't think they really understand kind of how the symptoms come on and what exactly the pathology there is. Could you define for us COPD, what it is, and why we sometimes don't recognize it in people until they're, say, in their 50s or 60s?
Well, COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, it's a treatable disease. It's also preventable, but it's not something that can be cured. It usually comes on slowly with symptoms, and it's generally associated with people who smoke tobacco. And it can be also caused by inhaling organic materials. If there's people who are cooking all the time with a fire or keeping a house heated with some kind of burning something. So there's the air kind of pollutants, I guess, particles can also be inhaled into the lung. And the tobacco smoke or whatever may be getting in there kind of sticks. The particles stick. The lungs begin to react to it. And slowly over time, you can develop this idea of COPD coming on. One leg of it would be chronic bronchitis, where you end up with a productive cough, and it's pretty frequent. And along with that, you also have shortness of breath. And it's being an obstructive disease, you end up having what would be considered kind of an air trapping picture, where you don't generally exhale as much as you usually would through a long, long time of building up a little bit of retained air in the lungs. So the air trapping ends up increasing your functional residual capacity, the FRC, and the airflow obstruction makes it real easy to get short of breath when you begin to exercise, because you're not getting air out of the lungs as well. So you have what they call dynamic hyperinflation sometimes occurring with these folks, which flattens the diaphragm and limits your ability to breathe. The other side, or the other leg of besides chronic bronchitis, would be emphysema. And that's where the alveoli actually begin to be destroyed. The lung kind of attacks itself in a little bit of a way, or you end up eating away at some of these areas that would be having fully functional alveoli. They end up developing what we call blebs or bulli, which are kind of just general holes in the lung. Look like if you had a sponge and dropped a bit of acid into the sponge, the acid would go down and eat away and then kind of create a cavity. So that's kind of what emphysema looks like if you're taking a look at it. And so it's not generally associated with the productive cough that you see with chronic bronchitis. They do have a cough, but a lot of times they may not cough up much of anything. It's a dry cough. And they also tend to have air trapping occurring with that, and the same problems with being very short of breath. But where the emphysema patients tend to look kind of, they generally, the general characteristic would be kind of a barrel-chested. They used to call them pink puffers, but they would be kind of skinny and having a larger chest than generally usually because of the air trapping, flattened diaphragm again, where the chronic bronchitis patient might be a little more overweight. They used the term blue bloater, so they kind of look a little overweight, may have some issues with their heart, so that they may have a little congestive heart failure on top of it. And they're not pink, they're kind of blue, they're a little cyanotic. So the kind of two general characteristics that are wrapped into COPD would be the chronic bronchitis and the emphysema picture in there. A lot of times it's not a pure division between them. You have a mixture of a little bit of both with a lot of patients. But generally it's from smoking. It takes a while for this to build up. So the symptoms are kind of gradual, and as they come up and get stronger, eventually the patient starts to think, well, I shouldn't be this short of breath when I'm walking up a hill or climbing stairs or even taking a shower. So that's what calls their attention to it. And they show up at the doctor's office, and then the physician during the evaluation should be able to come up with some reasonable idea that, hey, this looks like COPD. But the key point here is you really have to verify that by doing an objective test, which would be pulmonary function testing, or spirometry is the kind of the key element to taking a look at what's going on and get some objective measurements rather than just doing a clinical diagnosis. Catching somebody early in the stage often can help to, you can begin to alleviate some of the symptoms and get them away from the downhill slide if you can catch them early. Getting a baseline measurement lets you know where you're going in the future. Are they getting, you know, they're going downhill fast or kind of slow, or what's happening as far as progressing of the disease? So that's kind of a general overview of what is COPD and how does it develop and some of the pathophysiology behind it.
Yeah, no, that was great. That was a very, very good description, particularly differentiating between emphysema and chronic bronchitis, because I think that's something that a lot of people very much have wondered about. One quick follow-up, if you don't mind. I noticed you obviously the use of tobacco is, I think everyone recognizes that that's a huge contributing factor. You'd mentioned some of the, I guess, indoor pollutants from other devices or appliances. And of course, in the news very recently, there was just some communication coming from the government about natural gas stoves. They're not well ventilated. Would that be a potential trigger for COPD over time?
Burning natural gas doesn't release the same kind of particulates that you get when you're burning something like tobacco or organic materials. The gas stove issue is being stirred more by problems with asthma. So I don't think on the COPD side of the fence it's that big of a concern, but it is. Like exposure for children around a lot of gas burning stoves, they're wondering if there may be some link between burning that the natural gas and potential for asthma down the road.
Well, you talked about early detection and spirometry. Do you feel that primary care doctors should maybe incorporate more spirometry into their yearly physicals so that they can, on a basis, measure a person's lung and watch the progression and possibly catch some of these early detections of COPD?
Yeah, I think as far as the primary care offices, the physician's offices, that it's an easy test to do pretty much. If you have somebody who knows what they're doing, the equipment is not that expensive as far as a capital equipment purchase for the office. But I think it's very valuable in working with patients who you think have COPD, because if you can do it in the office, that's great. If not, then you're going to have to send them off to a lab somewhere. You know, the expense goes up, the cost of trying to get that measurement done. But I think primary care offices, if you have, you know, symptoms present and you've got a strong suspicion that the patient has COPD, it's certainly doable. That's one thing that the American Thoracic Society has been pushing for a good while, that primary care physicians should have spirometry available in their office in order to look for this. It's not a screening thing, but it's more of a, once you have a suspicion and you've got symptoms, it's a very valuable tool to gather information and make a firm diagnosis using something that's objective and not subjective.
Yeah, you know, another place that we often see the use of spirometry is within occupational health. Obviously, there's a lot of contaminants. It's OSHA regulated and that sort of thing. Is that the workplace exposure something that can lead to COPD as well?
Yeah, you can have jobs that are associated with, like I say, again, you're breathing in particulate matter, things that get into your lungs and stick, and then that starts down the pathway of COPD developing, and it can be in the workplace for sure.
What about gender? Is there any differences in gender when a person gets COPD? Does it affect women differently as compared to men, or is it about the same? What are your thoughts there?
Well, they're seeing an increase in COPD. They've seen this through the years, that women more and more are having the diagnosis of COPD. It's climbing in the female population. And the thought behind that is, back in the 70s, when they began to market very heavily, they were marketing cigarettes towards women. You know, it's the Virginia Slims. And if you remember back then, they had the slogan, "You've come a long way, baby." And women began to smoke a whole lot more back in the 70s compared to what men were doing. And I think that's led to an increase in the population, the female population showing up with COPD. Gender differences as far as how the disease behaves, I don't think we see much there. It tends to just, you know, it harms the lungs on either side of the fence as far as male versus female. But I think there is a rise in the incidence of COPD with females, and it's due to a lot of the smoking that's increased over the years since about the 1970s.
Yeah, definitely a case where gender equity is not welcome. It would have been better had we left them alone, I'm sure. With spirometry, it's obviously the established way of diagnosing COPD. Is it used as a basis for selecting the therapy or monitoring the progress of therapy after the fact?
It's rolled into the selection of therapy because it helps you to get an idea about the severity of the disease. There are guidelines out there. The most recent publication was the what they call GOLD. It's the Global Obstructive Lung Disease package that you can pick up. You know, it's an online guideline. It's very easy to get to. And I think they had a 2023 release, if I'm not mistaken. I know there's a 2022 version, but GOLD came out years ago, and they keep revising it and bringing it more up to date. But in the GOLD guidelines, that's part of the diagnostic workup, but it also helps to guide with COPD in spirometry. Like I say, it's part of the workup for the diagnosis, but it helps guide what selection of medications and how many things need to be called on to try and help the patient with their symptoms, you know, even getting into pulmonary rehab. But a lot of the medications are, you know, kind of a little bit driven by what you see with the spirometry, and then also with just the symptoms and how many exacerbations have you seen and how many times have they had to go in the hospital or emergency room related to their disease. So it is a pretty useful tool.
So what are some of the remedies or medications that are out there that are helping COPD? You've had a vast experience being a respiratory therapist, and then eventually went into education and training respiratory therapists. Have you seen through the years some innovative medications that have been helping with COPD? I know I've been reading a lot about stem cell research in regenerating some of the part of the lungs. What are you finding out there that been helping with the COPD diagnosis?
Well, the very first thing would be to encourage anybody who's got a problem with COPD to stop smoking, or to, you know, get away from whatever exposure they're having to this particulate matter that is causing the problem, because that just keeps loading on more damage. The medications that we've used through the years have evolved. Bronchodilators have improved a bunch back from, you know, when they first came out to now. They've had many generations of bronchodilators come out. The beta agonist drugs are kind of the number one start with things, which are bronchodilators that actively cause the airway to relax and open up. And they become more and more selective, so it doesn't have as much crossover and side effects in the heart. And they've also become more and more long lasting, where we used to have medications that would only last 4 to 6 hours. Now they've got some that are 24 hours in duration as far as that goes. The other area that's grown a lot has been in the muscarinic antagonists. So we call short-acting bronchodilators, are abbreviated as a SABA, a short-acting beta agonist. And then you also have short-acting muscarinic antagonist, or SAMA, SAMA. And then they've moved into long-acting beta agonists, the LABAs, and the long-acting muscarinic antagonists, which are LAMAs. Muscarinic antagonists, actually, they don't cause the airways to open up, but they kind of prevent them from closing back down again. So I kind of teaching the idea that a beta agonist drug would be more like opening the door, where the muscarinic antagonist would be like putting a doorstop in it so that the door wouldn't close again when you're talking about the airways. So those two, the beta agonists, the LABAs, and the LAMAs, the long-acting medications, have come along and grown a lot in the years. And then they've started adding on an inhaled corticosteroid, or an ICS, they call it. And those have also developed into where you got long-acting inhaled corticosteroids. So the big approach now for people who have COPD, and depending on how severe it is, but they like to use kind of a triple approach. So you have a LABA, a LAMA, and an ICS, the long-acting beta agonist, the long-acting muscarinic antagonist, and the inhaled corticosteroid packaged in one drug. And that seems to be more and more, you know, moving towards more effective relief of symptoms. And it's easier to use. A lot of these are just once a day inhaled medications. So you're not having to carry around a whole lot of different meds or use a lot of different inhalers. There's other medications that are being called on, and there's a lot of crossover with asthma, as they do some studies and look at how the lungs are affected by medications. So they're starting to see that there's some overlap in those medications. As far as the stem cell research you mentioned, Mark, you caught me on that one. I've not seen a lot there, but I'm maybe not reading the same areas that you're reading in. But I know that, you know, we're continually making advances, and there's constantly doing research to see what can we do to help these folks, because this is a terrible disease to get. When you get into the severe stages of it, you're just super limited as to what you can do. You're very short of breath, and it's kind of a miserable lifestyle if you're caught up in a severe case of COPD.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah, that on the stem cells, it's still in the preliminary stages. I know that there are a few things I've been reading about is been in trials, and we still don't know what capabilities of stem cell research is and helps with the body. On a personal note, I know I've mentioned before, my father has COPD, and he was a smoker, and it's a terrible disease. I've seen here in the last probably 5 years just completely destroy his health. It's tough to see.
Yeah. I would say the best advice, of course, is what you said earlier, and that is just don't smoke, right? That's probably the number one thing that we can all do. It's nice to see that we've got so many treatments coming online, but it would be so much better if we didn't have to have them in the first place. And I guess it begs maybe one further question is that, does everyone that smoke eventually develop COPD? Is it exclusive? And what are the risks with vaping? Is it similar in terms of COPD?
Well, the first part of your question, does everyone who smoke end up getting COPD? And that answer would be no, not necessarily. There are some people, it may be something related to their genetic makeup. Not sure what the answer there is, but there are people who can smoke and not develop it. But in the smoking population, that's a key starting point for getting COPD, and it's hard to know ahead of time. You can't predict who's going to have it and who's not. So it's kind of a roll of the dice, or you're playing kind of a Russian roulette picture when you pick up a pack of cigarettes and begin to smoke. And it usually takes years for it to develop. So you don't know what's going on until probably the earliest would be maybe 10 years of smoking history, maybe kind of a threshold. But once you cross that and start seeing symptoms, then you're on your way. For vaping, you're not burning tobacco leaves like the conventional cigarette would. So they've not seen very much association with COPD development as far as vaping goes, but it's still kind of an unknown as to what the long-term effects may be there. And of course, it depends on what you're putting into the vaping product. You know, some people load their own, so to speak. You could end up having things in there that could cause a lot of problems with the lungs, and they're seeing issues with that. So it's kind of a, it's an unknown situation right now as far as what I've seen. There have been some problems with vaping as far as potential development of problems like things like fibrosis or issues with other things going on. But I don't think I've seen much on the link to COPD. And I think it's because you're not burning matter, you know, to create the smoke like you would with a, you know, a cigar or a cigarette or a pipe or anything like that. You're not inhaling particulate matter that's been burned, so to speak.
One wrap-up question, Bill. You know, you just came out with an article on the top five spirometry tips for COPD diagnostic and management. Why don't you give those tips out to our audience?
I'd be glad to. Well, for the top five tips on spirometry, these are kind of some quick things to look at, but they involve a lot of detail behind them. Number one would be to make sure you calibrate your spirometry every day. The spirometer has to be accurate in what it's recording, so that you check that by calibration. And the other thing tied into that number one tip is making sure you have good infection control practices in place to protect your staff who are doing the test and to protect the patients as they perform the test. And there are guidelines that have been released. A lot of things have been updated with the COVID-19 issue. The pandemic has caused a hard look at this. So there, if you look online, you can find the guidelines that would give you and some information, particularly on infection control issues. And of course, the equipment manufacturers tell you about how to do your spirometry calibration, and that's important to follow those recommendations from the manufacturers. Number two on my tips would be to make sure you have a good detailed medical history and a physical exam. You want to look to see if there are any comorbid conditions that might contribute to the patient's shortness of breath or some of their other symptoms. And also on the physical exam, it's important to have an accurate measurement of their height and their weight. The height, particularly, and their age, and of course, gender, those three things kind of drive the predicted values for your patients. So knowing, you know, exactly what you have, you can't sometimes trust a patient. You say, well, how tall are you? And then, you know, some people will say, well, I'm 5'10", when they're really only 5'8". That can make a difference. Number three is patient preparation. The patient, when they're coming in for a test, should be wearing loose clothing, loose fitting clothes in order to do this. A very tight, you know, clothing could be kind of restrictive. And if they wear dentures, you want to make sure that they've got their dentures in place as far as that goes, if the dentures are well fitted. And you need to help them know ahead of time, get an idea of what this test looks like. Patient preparation also on the what the test looks like rolls into number four on my top five tips. As part of the patients, or part of your coaching, and then being patient with your patients. The coaching issue, you have to be very clear and pretty direct with how you instruct a patient to do these tests. And it's a good thing for them to sometimes see what's involved with this. If you're just describing it verbally, it doesn't have the same effect as them maybe actually seeing you with the effort you have to put into to get a full deep breath in and blast it out and to keep blowing and blow till you're empty. When they kind of see that demonstrated, it helps them to understand, oh, okay, it's a foreign maneuver. It's not something that you normally would ever do. You know, we take a deep breath in to blow out birthday candles, but it's not absolutely as full of deep breath in as sometimes you can get. And then once the candles get blown out, you kind of stop. Well, we don't want people to stop. We want them to continue blowing until they're fully emptied and have reached an expiratory plateau before they go and take another big deep breath back in again. You know, coaching is super important. Understanding what's coming next, you know, this test moves through rather quickly. So you have to be pretty well versed and know what to say next as you're reaching the different key points of getting a good recording. We want to have at least three really good tests that have been recorded in order to have a reliable look at things. Sometimes it takes us 6 or 7 or 8 attempts to get there. The coaching is important, and knowing what you're looking at as you're getting a recording is very important. So the fifth tip I would say is looking at the evaluation of the tests, making sure the quality is there, looking at the patient effort, and making sure that they're doing everything that they need to in order to get a reliable look at what's happening in their lungs and their airways. The patient's blowing all the way out and then sucking their air all the way back in. If they pull in a deep breath that's actually bigger than what they blew out, then there's a problem there. You know, this is one example of knowing what you're looking at, but if they pull in more air than they blew out, then they really didn't probably start at total lung capacity to begin with. So you have to go back and repeat that and have them do a better shot at it. Other things like coughing in the middle of the test, depends on where that happens, but sometimes you can accept a cough, but sometimes it's actually not going to work and you have to do it again. So those kind of things are important. I think of the top five, I would approach spirometry with those five things in mind.
Well, Bill, this has been great information. We appreciate you taking the time. We ran into each other. I saw your article in RT Magazine, the top five spirometry tips for COPD diagnosis and management. You mentioned that you're going to be a guest writer in a lot of different journals and publications. We look forward to your next article. Is there anything else you'd like to say on this issue?
Well, I think we covered what we've so far discussed pretty thoroughly. It's something that I know respiratory therapists are greatly influenced by and see a lot of COPD patients. It shows up across the span of medicine, so everybody's involved with it. But I think getting folks to stop smoking or to not start is a big beginning point. And then I think if you're starting to see something that would, you know, you're thinking this could be COPD, I think it's very important to get spirometry done in order to confirm that.
Well, thanks again for being on our podcast, Bill.
Thank you for having me.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Exhale Podcast. Don't forget to follow us for upcoming new episodes and recommend this podcast to friends and family. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us again on the Exhale Podcast, brought to you by Vitalograph.